and he got shut down.
Podcasting from an underground studio flying under the radar, this is Dan. By day, I'm a professor of cognitive neuroscience, and by night, I retreat into my subterranean lair and dig deep into the thoughts of mankind.
And I'm Dave, sitting firmly atop the Great Canadian Shield in Northern Ontario. I'm a pastor by profession, and a part of that includes unmasking the messaging that comes at us each and every day.
You're listening to the Not Conformed Podcast,
where we're hunkering down for yet another lockdown.
Yeah, unfortunately, Dan, and the way this one was advertised is very interesting. First of all, I think you probably noticed that Sunday, December 20th, just before Christmas there, most of our Canadian news outlets were saying that sources say, quote unquote, that Ontario will be put in lockdown on Christmas Eve. And so we had all these headlines, the CTV News, Ontario will enter province-wide lockdown as of Christmas Eve, sources say, and the Globe and Mail. Ontario expected to enter full lockdown on Christmas Eve, sources say, in 680 News, which they've pulled, by the way, but you can still find it. Hashtag breaking, all regions of the province will enter lockdown stage at 12:01 a.m. on December 24th, sources indicate to 680 News.
Yep.
And so, now, I mean, it's nothing to laugh about, but what was interesting is that on Monday afternoon, then, when the actual announcement came out, turns out that the cabinet had made the decision maybe after the fact to close the province down on Boxing Day.
Right.
And so
there
was this interesting phenomenon where we were led to expect the worst, mm-hmm. and then just relieved to find out that the lockdown was going to occur after Christmas.
Yeah. You know, I had the same experience of relief. And it's bizarre, right? Because we're feeling relief to learn about a ridiculous tyrannical lockdown.
That's right.
So yeah, that's a fascinating manipulation technique, and it needs a name. And again, we don't know whether this was intentionally set up this way, but if it was, and it certainly could be, it needs a name. And I'm just making one off the top of my head here. How about the, I don't know, bad to good news technique? Yeah, it's kind of crap.
Yeah. Or maybe something like the manufactured silver lining technique, or maybe the manufactured relief technique.
Yeah, the manufactured relief technique, because they're manufacturing relief in us so that we are more likely to accept what we would otherwise not accept. It's excellent. I love it, Dave. The manufactured relief technique.
Yeah, Dan, that's good. We got to write that one down and add it to the list. Now, before we go on, we should welcome everyone to episode 25 of the Not Conform Show. Welcome, everyone.
Yeah, indeed. Welcome, listeners. And let's start with maybe a quick update.
Yeah, good idea. You'll remember that last episode, we covered many eminent doctors and scientists that were banned by the mainstream media and online platforms for dissenting from approved, quote unquote, COVID messaging, right? Mm-hmm. We talked about Dr. Scott Atlas, who's since been anathematized by his former peers at Stanford, quite literally. And then we talked about the group of scientists behind the Great Barrington Declaration who are criticizing the lockdown approach, which keeps gathering steam. At the latest count, I think it was, there was almost 40,000 medical practitioners. There was just over 13,000 medical and public health scientists who had signed it. So the people that are expert in this field, and there was almost 40,000 medical practitioners that had signed it. And there was over 700,000 concerned citizens signing it. So, I mean, those are the least relevant because they don't have any expertise, but it's interesting, right? And more and more people keep harping on this, even as our politicians keep going into lockdown, lockdown, lockdown.
Mm-hmm.
And we also talked about the World Doctor Alliance, based in Europe, also advocating against the lockdown approach and the problems with the PCR testing. And then we talked about Dr. Simone Gold and America's frontline doctors who are trying to bring the good news of successful off-the-shelf treatment modalities, including hydroxychloroquine.
Mm-hmm.
And to that list, I would like to add the FLCCC, and that's the Frontline COVID-19 Critical Care Alliance. And you can find them at COVID19criticalcare.com. So COVID19criticalcare.com, it'll be in the show notes. And what they're all about is prophylaxis and treatment protocols for COVID-19. And I really recommend listeners watch the embedded video where Dr. Pierre Corey testifies to the U.S. Senate committee about another treatment modality, that's ivermectin. And it's very interesting because in this video, he points out that there has been no committee tasked with researching and analyzing off-the-shelf, ready, available treatment options.
Yeah,
and
repurposing treatment options, yeah, repurposing right. other drugs. Yes.
And we've seen this actually as a pattern, because I've noticed critical people pointing out that this happened exactly the same way with the previous, you know, H1N1, swine mm-hmm. flu, and bird flu. All the focus was on vaccines, and none of the focus, or even intentionally marginalized, was anybody that was coming up with actually off the shelf working stuff that actually cured people. So very interesting. Again, it reinforces this whole narrative that we unpacked last episode, and definitely check out the FLCCC.
Yeah, Dave, I actually looked up some articles on ivermectin, and it does seem to have the effects that were advertised by the good doctor there who was testifying. So that is something to follow for sure. Now, in other news, Dave, the Great Reset has gone viral since our last episode.
That's right. It has. You know, it's actually one of our listeners wrote in and noted that we talked about this back in May before this was even on anybody's radar. There was very few people talking about it. And so here's the email. This is from listener Indy. And thanks for sending the email. We appreciate it. I was introduced to your podcast by a pastor in Australia. Your podcast in May is nearly prophetic with the Great Reset. Staying awake in Florida, keep up the great work. Thank you. So yeah, that reminded me, we did talk about this back then.
Yeah, we did.
And Dan, I grabbed the clip that's making the rounds with Trudeau addressing, I think it was the UN. It's the short clip anyways, that's been making the Twitter rounds. And in it, he manages to get all the key terms in and all the talking points. Listen to this.
Building back better means giving support to the most vulnerable while maintaining our momentum on reaching the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development and the SDGs. Canada is here to listen and to help. This pandemic has provided an opportunity for a reset. This is our chance to accelerate our pre-pandemic efforts to reimagine economic systems that actually address global challenges like extreme poverty, inequality, and climate change.
That's awesome, man. He's got all the buzzwords in there, right? Opportunity, the reset, reimagining. And Dave, he sounds just like the founder of the World Economic Forum, Klaus Schwab, whom we covered way back when, a few episodes ago. And it turns out that Schwab co-authored a book titled COVID and the Great Reset, which focuses on using COVID essentially as an opportunity to accelerate the Great Reset. And I've got tons of quotes from this, but I'll just choose this one short one. He writes the following, quote, "The broader point is this, I guess, of his whole book. The possibilities for change and the resulting new order are now unlimited and only bound by our imagination, for better or for worse." Then he goes on, "We should take advantage of this unprecedented opportunity to reimagine our world in a bid to make it a better and more resilient one as it emerges on the other side of this crisis," end quote. There you go. Reimagining the future and building back better with the Great Reset. And COVID-19 has created the opportunity for it all.
That's right. And then you roll in climate change and all that stuff. And we pointed this out before, but of course, Joe Biden and his Great Reset talk, it's all the same. It seems like it's coming out of the same playbook. And I would suspect that the thought leader here is Klaus Schwab of the World Economic Forum, as we pointed out way back in May.
Exactly.
So, and you know, it sounds great. It sounds great. But the thing is that you have to ask the question then is, what do these guys have in mind in terms of resetting?
There's actually, you could read his book, and I have tons of quotes because he lays it out there play by play what he wants to do. And it ain't good for us.
No, definitely not. And if in Canada, we start seeing things like we've talked about the basic personal income rollout in 2021, we know that Schwab playbook is in play, and it doesn't look good.
Yeah, right? That's right. It's going to be a whole wealth redistribution plan, complete socialism and technocratic tyranny.
This is the Not Conform Show. Make sure you tell everyone you know.
All right, Dave. So let's set the table for this episode. In the last few episodes, we have talked about various things, including the shock doctrine, which is used to advance elite agendas. We talked about this very dubious and suspicious COVID-19 situation, complete with censorship, vilification of dissenters, mischaracterization of the scientific evidence, and lots of propaganda, the whole nine yards. We talked about the Great Reset. We just did that again. Now, the obvious question is, could all of these share a common ancestry? Now, of course, any suggestion that current major world events like these might be more deeply connected and that they might have emerged from a common organized movement would rapidly be dismissed as a conspiracy theory. And I would venture to say that if you made such a suggestion, you would be immediately shamed and considered to be a backward, you know, uneducated, right-wing, gullible, QAnon believing nut. But the case we want to make today is that historical and current events have not and do not unfold in a random fashion. They're not disconnected. Rather, we want to illustrate that to a great extent, current major world events reflect an underlying connected structure, one that's not fully apparent to most citizens because it's been obscured by design. It's been mostly hidden from view, though now I think more and more it's coming out into the open.
I agree, Dan. And we should, before we move on, we should probably talk a little bit more about this idea and this concept of conspiracy theory, because I think it's going to be a stumbling block for many. And so I have this great clip from a lecture by G. Edward Griffin, where he talks about this concept of conspiracy and its role in history. And so this is from a lecture titled The Quigley Formula, and it's on YouTube still. I highly recommend Griffin's books and lectures. And as I recall, this was one of those talks that originally got us interested in this stuff. And you can let us to look at the primary sources, which we'll be quoting a little bit of today. And so this is from that, from the Quigley Formula. And it's, this is about a minute 41 or minute 41 seconds. So let me play it.
Now, I've mentioned the word conspiracy before. I'll probably be using it again several times today. And that causes some concern for a lot of people because it's kind of a knee-jerk reaction for people to say, oh, you believe in conspiracy? What are you, a conspiracy theorist of some kind? Well, I'm certainly not a conspiracy theorist. When people take that position, I have to laugh because I feel sorry for them. They've obviously never read a history book. Because anyone who knows anything about history knows that it's built on conspiracies from one end to the other. Conspiracy is the engine of history. Every major event in history, when you examine it, has come to pass largely as a result of at least one, and in many cases, many conspiracies. And it goes on today. These people have never sat in a courtroom and listened to lawyers try men and corporations on the charge of conspiracies. Conspiracies in corporations, conspiracies in families, conspiracies from top to bottom. Conspiracies are a fact of life. And for anybody to say that conspiracies are absurd and that anyone who thinks that conspiracies are real is a conspiracy theorist has a real problem. I do not have this problem. I know the conspiracies are real, and we'll be talking about a very real conspiracy today, and we'll document it with the words of the people themselves who are involved in it, and they're very proud of it.
Yeah, so you notice that he talks about the conspiracy, that conspiracy is the engine of history, and maybe that's one of our, maybe that's a show title we should keep in mind, engine. The engine of history.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool.
Spiritual view of history or something like that. And the point that he makes is that we need to get past this, or the point we certainly want to make is we need to get past this intellectually kind of juvenile dismissal of anything that challenges our worldview as just another quote unquote conspiracy theory, right? Because labeling something as conspiracy theory is not really an argument. It's just it's a dismissal of an argument. And we need to start looking at the facts. And being as equally critical of the mainstream narrative as we are of potential conspiracy theories.
Yeah, right? And Dave, the key thing here is being equally critical right? Because people are generally uncritical of the mainstream, and then they're taught to be critical of every other view out there. And we want to equalize that.
We want to be equally critical. And so it's not about accepting anything and everything, but to be equally, to apply the same critical eye and look at the, be willing to look at all the evidence. And, you know, one of the people that, one of the groups of people that regularly deal with potential conspiracies are people like, who are either investigators or lawyers. And a while back, I collected this clip of Canadian constitutional lawyer, Rocco Galati. And, he talks about, I got it because I like the way he talks about being not a conspiracy theorist, but a conspiracy analyst. And this is from an interview conducted by Ezra Levant of Rebel News, where he's interviewing Galati about his lockdown lawsuit against the government for their mania and panic during this pandemic. And it's about a minute long, so let me play it for you.
And can I just briefly say something about conspiracy theories? I don't think of myself as a conspiracy theorist. I'm a conspiracy analyst. Mm. I used to work for the Department of Justice, and we did a lot of drug prosecutions. We used to prosecute conspiracy and drug dealing all the time. And what the term conspiracy theory comes from, it was invented by the CIA to deflect and given to the media to deflect questions about the JFK assassination and to undermine Martin Luther King's civil rights movement. Okay, what a conspiracy theory is, it's a propaganda tool to actually dismiss, deflect, and hide conspiracies. That's what it is. And conspiracies are both a criminal code offense in Canada and actionable tort. All a conspiracy is, Ezra, is two or more people agreeing to a certain end. Right. If that end is criminal, it's a criminal conspiracy.
Right.
If that end is not criminal, but it harms somebody else in their rights, civil rights, they can sue you in conspiracy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I like this business. I don't think of myself as a conspiracy theorist. I'm a conspiracy analyst. And, and as we said, that's what we need to be in our propagandized world, shrewd conspiracy analysts.
Yeah, Dave, that's a fantastic clip. And of course, this is not to say that there are some conspiracy theories that are wrong, right? It's to say that labeling things and ideas as conspiracy theories is a way to just deflect away from something that might really be there, that may or may not be there, may or may not be true.
Yep.
But yeah, I think that the mainstream media just generally doesn't want you to think for yourself. They just want you to suck on their teat. So you only get their carefully curated buffet of selected information. And I have some examples of this, how they're trying to essentially proactively label certain ideas as conspiracy theories, any ideas that don't seem to comport with their mainstream worldview. And so there was this BBC article published on December 21st titled, "How Should You Talk to Friends and Relatives Who Believe Conspiracy Theories?" So this is an instruction manual, Dave, on how to talk to people who have a view that's different from the mainstream. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in this patronizing and condescending way, the author gives the following advice. He says, number one, you should keep calm. Number two, don't be dismissive. Number three, encourage critical thinking. So ironic. Number four, ask questions. And number five, don't expect immediate results. And so those are just the headings of each of the subsections. And under the encourage critical thinking subheading, we read the following, quote, "People who believe conspiracy theories often say, I do my own research." And then we read, quote, "But the spirit of doubt that pervades the conspiracy-minded internet is actually a key opening for rational thought," says Jovan Byford. "Many people who believe in conspiracy theories see themselves as healthy skeptics and self-taught researchers into complex issues." He says, "Present this as something that, in principle, you value and share. Your aim is not to make them less curious or skeptical, but to change what they are curious about or skeptical of." End quote. So, okay.
So these aren't the droids you're looking for.
These aren't the droids you're looking for. That's another show title. Yeah. So writing to the brainwashed mainstream media reader, the author is saying that the reader's friends are really not capable of doing their own research because they're just sheep. and that they need to be made skeptical of any views that differ from the accepted mainstream media view. I mean, it's kind of shocking. And the question I would ask is, why is this sort of article released just before Christmas? Well, it might be because that is when people get together and share information. And I think this article is meant to inoculate the readers, those media teat-sucking babies out there, against what the media authors deem to be wrongthink, right? So they're trying to basically get ahead of things and inoculate people. Because you see, when people gather physically with one another, particularly with family members, it's problematic for propagandists because they lose control over the narratives that people are exposed to. And Dave, I'm reminded of Jacques Ellul. Do you remember this guy, Jacques Ellul?
Yep.
Yeah, so he wrote this book in 1965 called Propaganda, The Formation of Men's Attitudes. It's another one of these classic books I think we mentioned in some of the first episodes that we've ever done.
We did.
But I'm just reminded of this one section here where he talks about propaganda. Here's what he says, quote, "Propaganda must be continuous and lasting. Continuous in that it must not leave any gaps, but must fill the citizen's whole day and all his days. Lasting in that it must function over a very long period of time. Propaganda tends to make the individual live in a separate world. He must not have outside points of reference. He must not be allowed a moment of meditation or reflection in which he sees himself vis-a-vis the propagandist, as happens when the propaganda is not continuous. At that moment, the individual emerges from the grip of propaganda." End quote. Right? So this is, I think, what the mainstream media is trying to avoid. It's trying to avoid you emerging from their grip of propaganda. And so they do this proactive move where they try to inoculate you against it ahead of time.
Yeah. No, that's good.
Yeah. Because, you know, Dave, family groupings are, I think, especially dangerous for propagandists because they're not organized strictly around the propagandist messaging. There is this inconvenient possibility of dissenting voices popping up because, you know, family members, they're typically grouped by biology, not by ideology, which is, you know, why the propagandists always want to disrupt these sorts of family groupings with, well, lockdowns, for example.
Yeah, it's interesting that the lockdowns at Christmas seem to also serve that purpose, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, and that's definitely interesting.
Yeah. And because the propagandists know they will momentarily lose control when families get together, they have to take this preemptive action, which involves labeling views that diverge from the mainstream media narrative as conspiracy theories and preparing their listeners, you know, to avoid those ideas at all costs.
Yeah, Dan, exactly. And I don't know if you remember, but this isn't the first type of article that we've talked about this. We've seen these articles pop up over the course of this pandemic. First, I remember seeing one when that Epoch Times documentary tracking down the origins of the Wuhan coronavirus came out in April, and that went viral. And there was exactly this type of article plugged in targeting that messaging or the content of that dismissive of the content of that documentary. And then we had the viral Plandemic and Plandemic 2 documentaries come out a bit later. And again, the articles came out about that in the same vein of how to talk to your nutty uncle, right, about that. And it was, again, it was not a refutation, but an inoculation against these ideas. Mm-hmm. Now, it's interesting because the article that you mentioned, and we'll put the link in the show notes, is interesting because the advice in it cuts both ways when you look at the advice it gives, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's very often those who only nurse the mainstream narrative that need to be patiently, you know, they're the ones that need to be patiently encouraged towards critical thinking. And so those be patient and encourage, you know, it's all applied, cuts both ways. And much of that article applies as well if you're talking to somebody who's stuck on the mainstream. Now, that article in that way is a bit more neutral than there's two other articles that are linked in that article. Mm-hmm. And those you'll see are much more dismissive of how they label those as conspiracy theorists. And they try to assign motives and otherwise cast them in a negative light and have people that have, you know, testimonies of people that have come out of holding some conspiratorial view and whatnot. So This is absolutely counter propaganda, and it has to be labeled as that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, for those who want to dig a little bit deeper into the history of that term conspiracy theory and the CIA connection that Galati mentioned in that clip, I have a great clip from Mark Crispin Miller where he unpacks this. And this is a clip from an interview that Miller gave on the Tom Woods Show. That was episode 1760. It's a little bit long. It's like 2.5 minutes, but I think it's worth it because it he lays out the whole thing. So let me play that for you.
I guess the other book I would strongly recommend is called Conspiracy Theory in America by Lance DeHaven Smith. That's a hyphenated name. This is a book by a professor of public policy at Florida Atlantic University. I think he's retired now. I asked him to write this book for a series I was editing at the University of Texas Press. This is a must read because it explains how it came to happen that the phrase conspiracy theory and conspiracy theorist became such widely used pejorative terms, because conspiracy theory wasn't really much used by U.S. journalists until 1967, and conspiracy theorist was never used. It was the CIA that actually weaponized the term in 67. There's a memo, 1035-960, which people can find online, that lays out why they did. I mean, you can read the memo. Their purpose of weaponizing the term was to discredit books that were questioning the Warren Report on JFK Dallas. And these books were selling handsomely, and the CIA was concerned about that. So they urged their station chiefs worldwide to use their media connections to generate hostile reviews and articles so that people would distrust these critiques. And that was a staggeringly successful propaganda drive that never stopped as the phrase conspiracy theory continued to be used, you know, through the Bobby and King assassinations and through the October surprise in 1980 and Iran-Contra and 9/11 and up to today. Now everybody uses it. We all use it. We all say, oh, that's a conspiracy theory. Or we say, this I hear people say a lot, well, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but, right? Then they'll say something perfectly rational. I mean, there's something really important about having a healthy distrust of elite intentions. I mean, that's as American as apple pie. That's the Declaration of Independence, one long conspiracy theory.
Yeah, so Dan, this is an academic book. This is a University of Texas Press book. It's not it's not just one of these kind of run-of-the-mill pundit books, you know, that come out a dime a dozen.
Yeah, Dave, we should introduce Mark Crispin Miller to our listeners because he's a fantastic guy. For those who don't know, Miller is a professor at New York University, and he is an expert on propaganda. And for many years, I understand, he's taught a very popular course on propaganda at NYU. And in fact, Miller wrote the foreword to the recent reprint of Edward Bernays' famous book titled Propaganda, which we featured in one of our earliest episodes. And it was Miller's preface, in fact, to Bernays' book that pointed us to some of the other material that we covered in our earlier episodes. And in fact, I have Bernays' book here at my elbow, even as we do this episode. Now, just to show you how small the world is and the nuttiness of this COVID situation, it turns out that Miller recently landed in hot water for discussing masking in his propaganda class.
Mm-hmm.
I have a clip here. Listen to this description of the situation. And this is again from the Tom Woods Show.
In late September, I was attacked on Twitter by a student infuriated by my having encouraged my propaganda class to look into the scientific studies on the effectiveness of masks as a barrier against respiratory viruses. And what was especially troubling about this attack, which was unprecedented for me. I mean, I've had students disagree in class. I encourage that, but this was very different. What was really troubling about it was that NYU essentially took her side. The chair tweeted his thanks to her. She'd asked that I be fired, and he said, we as a department have made this a priority and are discussing next steps, which, you know, was staggering for a few reasons. Then the dean of the school and the doctor who advises NYU on its COVID regulations, which are draconian, emailed my other students without putting me on copy, essentially telling them that I had given them dangerous misinformation and sending links to studies they should read and believe. Studies I had also recommended to the class because I believe in comprehensive scrutiny of all available evidence. And then I was pressured into canceling the propaganda class for next semester in favor of two sections of my film course. I mean, I've been teaching the propaganda course for, you know, at least 20 years. It's very popular. But the rationale was that the film class has really high enrollments and it would be good for the department. The only problem with that rationale is that they are equally crowded classes.
Yeah, so he brought up the possibility that there might be an alternative perspective on the effects of masking and the ability of masking to stop COVID-19. And he got shut down by his fellow faculty members, Dave. This is completely frightening. I'm a faculty member. This is something that I might bring up in one of my classes. And he got shut down. His course is done for now.
Yeah. And by the way, Dan, I think it's this, that was from a more recent episode. I think, 17, the Tom Woods 1797 demonized for wrong thing on masks and other topics. Professor confronts his accusers. It's definitely an episode worth listening because you get a sense of how this is happening for bizarre reasons all over the place. This kind of deplatforming and shutting down of thought.
Yeah, and notice that he says he tries to get people to think critically about all views. And in order to do that, you have to present other views, right? But that's exactly what they don't want you to do. You know, they don't want you to present alternative views in the academic setting because they believe that somehow gives them legitimacy. But that just basically undermines, that strategy undermines any kind of, you know, academic thinking and free speech for that matter and academic freedom for that matter. I mean, it just undermines the whole thing.
That's right.
But yeah, Dave, you I want to go back to your point about the CIA weaponizing the term conspiracy theory, because that's how we got into this Mark Crispin Miller stuff.
Right. Yeah. So he mentions that book, and my copy just arrived and I'm waving it in front of my camera here. This really works on audio. it's called Conspiracy Theory in America by Lance DeHaven Smith. And again, he this is an academic book because he's a professor, or he was at the time of writing, he was a professor in the Reuben O.D. Askew School of Public Administration and Policy at Florida State University in Tallahassee. And I'm looking at, this is a copyright 2013. So it's you know, it's fairly up to date, but not, obviously not the latest stuff. And, you know, he gets into this business of the origins of the term conspiracy theory, how it became used as a tool to dismiss and suppress facts that the three-letter agencies didn't want getting out. And so far, I've just looked at it, just showed up. It took quite a long time to show up. And so far, it's excellent. And we're going to have to do another segment on this, maybe in a future episode, because I realize that this is going to be a continuing problem. People wrapping their brains around the worldview shift that needs to take place as you think about these things. And you know, in that same vein, I've got one more clip here before we move on to the content part of the episode. And this is, this also helps put in perspective why we're covering this material that we're going to be covering. And again, this is from Rocco Galati, the same interview that I mentioned before. And he talks about why it's important to understand the geopolitical and economic forces that are underlying the things that we're seeing happen around us. Listen to this.
And I can tell you, I spend 3 hours of my day every morning in my office just clearing phone calls and emails. I don't necessarily even respond to them all. I get 300, 400 of these of people crying on the phone, telling me, you know, this is what's happening to me. What's going on? This is insane. Experts calling me, medical and scientific experts calling me and saying, this makes no scientific sense whatsoever. What's going on here? And I tell them, go read my statement of claim and go do some research, because unless you understand the geopolitical economic forces behind these measures, the science will never make sense to you. Because Teresa Tam and the other medical officers have been vacillating like palm trees in a Hawaii tornado. Every week, it's something contradictory, as Fauci has.
Yeah.
Have you had a straight line from these people?
Yeah.
The goalposts keep changing.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's interesting, right? He says the experts are calling him up and asking, what's going on here? What's going on here? This doesn't make sense. The science does not support this. And Gulati's point is you need to understand the geopolitical and economic forces at play. Otherwise, you will not be able to make sense of the times. And so things like these mask mandates that have no real science backing. I mean, first they're no good, then they're good, then they're no good again. It goes back and forth. Fauci changes his mind 10 times. Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos doubling their fortunes while lockdowns destroy small businesses and people's financial self-sufficiency and cripple the Western economy for maybe at least the next generation, maybe two.
Yeah.
Right. All this talk about Build Back Better, the Great Reset, the Fourth Industrial Revolution, all that stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And then you've got the massive media collusion to blockade the scientific and the medical information on COVID-19, right? Last episode. Or the massive media blockade, for those of you who have been paying attention, on the 2020 U.S. election fraud. Or the Hunter Biden stuff even just before that, right?
Yeah.
The talk of the forced vaccinations, the COVID passports, the invasive tracking, none of this really makes sense. It just seems like a random thing and disconnected. Without the puzzle pieces that we're going to lay down in this and upcoming episodes, it doesn't really make sense. And it will once you see what's going on.
This is the Not Conformed Show. Make sure you tell everyone you know.
So today we want to put some of these puzzle pieces together by discussing the origins of what has become a global conspiracy, one that is not a theory, it's historical fact. And I should say this again so that everyone understands, we're not dealing with a conspiracy theory, but with very well documented conspiratorial facts. And Dave, I just had our producers put together a jingle for this.
Conspiracy fact.
Great. That's great.
Yeah, just to remind us that this is conspiracy fact, not a conspiracy theory. And yeah, perhaps the best place to start when unraveling this ball of yarn is with the story of Cecil Rhodes, as told by the famous historian Professor Carol Quigley. Now, Professor Carol Quigley wrote two books that detail the operation of a secret society to which he says he had access. At least he had access to their documents. And the two books are titled, well, the first one is Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. And that one was published in 1966. It's this massive, thick book. And the second one that I'm referring to is titled The Anglo-American Establishment, which came out in, I think, in 1981. And I think Quigley died in 1977, so it came out just after he died. It's a thinner book and certainly a faster read. But just to be clear, Carol Quigley is a guy, despite what one might infer from the sound of his name. And he was a highly regarded and respected professor of history at Georgetown University in the School of Foreign Service.
Yeah, Dan, and here's a quote from Quigley's bio from one of his books. He was also an instructor at Princeton and Harvard. As a consultant, he made contributions to the U.S. Department of Defense, the House Committee on Astronautics and Space Exploration, and the U.S. Navy. Quigley's other works include Evolution of Civilizations and his major tome, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. And that's from the foreword there.
Yeah. Yeah. Evolution of Civilizations was one of the books that he became very famous for. But as you can see, this guy was not a hack. He was not a slouch or a right-wing conspiracy theorist, to use that term pejoratively. He was an esteemed academic who had insider access to the documents of an elite group that we'll be talking about today. And I should also mention this, Dave, that he was very left-leaning. And he viewed the far right as an anathema, as something to be reviled and rejected. So there is no way he had a right-leaning bias, which might have motivated him to make some of this stuff up, okay?
No, no. And in fact, he seems to almost come across in some of his work as an apologist for this conspiratorial group, right? Agreeing with them in most things.
Yeah, so. And Dave, and for our left-leaning friends out there, Quigley was in fact an inspiration to none other than former President of the United States of America, Bill Clinton. Here it is in Bill's own words.
As a teenager, I heard John Kennedy's summons to citizenship. And then as a student at Georgetown, I heard that call clarified by a professor named Carol Quigley.
I did not have relations with that. No. So there you go. A former U.S. Democratic president endorses Professor Carol Quigley.
Yeah. And it's very telling that Clinton is very clearly signaling, right? It's one of these dog whistles they keep accusing Trump about in his speech, telling the other elites that he's in tune with the Quigley formula, right? It's a great find. Good find, Dan.
Yeah.
And we should also mention that there's a great summary of Quigley's material in a book by Joseph Plummer called Tragedy and Hope 101, The Illusion of Justice, Freedom, and Democracy. And that's a much shorter read. It's a great summary of Quigley's work and also an analysis of it as well. So I'll put that in the show notes as well.
Yeah.
Okay, Dan. So what does Professor Quigley tell us?
Okay, well, in his book, The Anglo-American Establishment, and actually some of this material is also covered in his other books, Quigley starts by describing the formation of a secret society in the late 1800s consisting of a few British elites, the main one of whom was a guy named Cecil Rhodes. Now, some of our listeners might recognize the name Rhodes because it's the name of an esteemed academic scholarship known as the Rhodes Scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in academic circles, if you're a Rhodes Scholar, you're part of this academic elite and are viewed as a bright light that has achieved or is destined to achieve greatness. And as you might have guessed, that scholarship got its name from Cecil Rhodes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Dan, so why don't you give us some background? Who is this Cecil Rhodes?
Well, Rhodes was an insanely rich diamond and gold magnate. He came to South Africa from Britain at a young age and joined his brother, who happened to have a claim in the De Beers diamond mine in South Africa. And initially, there were many different people working claims in the mine, which, by the way, turned out to be one of the largest diamond mines in the world. But Rhodes quickly expanded his holdings and monopolized the diamond industry in South Africa. And according to Quigley, Rhodes had financial help in building his monopoly from Lord Rothschild, the banking mogul, and at least one other rich investor. And later, Rhodes was heavily involved in gold mining as well in parts of Africa. So he basically was a monopolist, and he was successful in building a diamond monopoly. And he named his company De Beers after the name of the mine. And of course, we still have De Beers Jewelers with us today, which is an offshoot of that company.
Yeah.
But Rhodes didn't see wealth as the only end in itself. And here's the important part. He sought to use his wealth to promote the world view of the British elite and to expand the British Empire, particularly in South Africa. And in Africa, Rhodes obtained land by swindling the natives and through aggressive military action. There's some interesting documentaries that you can find online that go through that history. And he would use various dubious means to gain the land, to gain more wealth. And he ended up expanding the British Empire and creating Rhodesia, which was, of course, named after him, which is now known as Zimbabwe.
Yeah, it's a very interesting history, this history of the Boer Wars. It's very interesting, especially in light of what's going on over there, especially in South Africa.
Yeah.
And you know, prior to this research into Rhodes, I didn't know any of that stuff. You just don't learn about it. And you really can't understand what's going on over there without first knowing the story of what those really conniving Brits did over there in South Africa, Rhodesia, all those places.
Why were we never taught this?
Exactly. It's weird.
It was a world-changing history that has shaped the world that we know today, and we were never taught this in school.
Yeah, and it's not controversial. This stuff is completely accepted.
Yeah,
and it's not anything nutty. It's just not covered, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, Dan, you said Rhodes was primarily interested in using his money to promote a world view. So let's get into that. What is this? What is it that inspired him to do this?
Yeah, this is an interesting story. So as a young man, Rhodes left South Africa for a period of time to attend Oxford, which is perhaps a top university in Britain. And it's partly because he realized that in order to be anybody in British society, you had to go to Oxford. So while at Oxford, he attended a lecture by the famous art critic John Ruskin, who extolled the virtues of the British upper class culture and the need to spread that culture to the masses. In fact, not only to the British masses, but the whole world. Quigley documents this in chapter 4, I think it is, in his massive book, Tragedy and Hope. He writes the following, quote, "Ruskin spoke to the Oxford undergraduates as members of the privileged ruling class. He told them that they were the possessors of a magnificent tradition of education, beauty, rule of law, freedom, decency, and self-discipline, but that this tradition could not be saved and did not deserve to be saved unless it could be extended to the lower classes in England itself and to the non-English speaking masses throughout the world.
Yeah.
If this precious tradition were not extended to these two great majorities, the minority of upper class Englishmen would ultimately be submerged by these majorities and the tradition lost. To prevent this, the tradition must be extended to the masses and to the empire." Ruskin's message had a sensational impact. His inaugural lecture was copied out in longhand by one undergraduate, Cecil Rhodes, who kept it with him for 30 years, end quote. Yeah. So Cecil Rhodes was there and he took the notes. And by the way, Dave, we were talking on the phone a few days ago and I was walking by my bookshelf and I have these old books. I think it's the Harvard Classics. And so it covers some of the classic works. And it just so happened, there's a whole chapter there on Ruskin's work. And the different kinds of lectures that he gave are actually in this book. So this is not a nobody. This guy, you know, has made his way into this Harvard compendium of classic works.
So somebody thought that this was an important part of the Western canon, right?
Of the corpus.
Thinkers. Yeah. Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. Now here's the important part, Dave. Ruskin believed that people should be governed by those who are superior to others, even if that meant a dictatorship. He essentially believed in a benevolent dictatorship.
Oh yeah. I've got a great Ruskin quote presented by G. Edward Griffin from his documentary, The Capitalist Conspiracy, another great YouTube video. Let me play that for you, Dan.
Okay.
"In 1870, a wealthy British socialist by the name of John Ruskin was appointed as professor of fine arts at Oxford University in London. He taught his students that the state must take control of the means of production and organize them for the good of the community as a whole. But he advocated placing control of the state into the hands of a single dictator. He said, 'My continual aim has been to show the eternal superiority of some men to others, sometimes even of one man to all others.'"
Yeah, so you listen to that and you realize that Ruskin sounds like a socialist who wanted a permanent dictatorship, which I guess is every socialist.
Yeah, that's precisely it. Yeah. I think it's worth noting that according to Quigley, Ruskin was promoting imperialism, which is the spreading of the British Empire across the world, but one which was different from the earlier forms of imperialism. And he says the following, quote, "The chief changes were that it was justified on grounds of moral duty and of social reform, and not, as earlier, on grounds of missionary activity and material advantage." And so the key point here is that it was justified by moral duty. They had to expand the British Empire because it was their moral obligation. And we see this sort of justification for global action even today. You know, just think of global warming and saving the world from spiky balls of COVID, right? It's all about moral, it's all about moral actions.
Yeah, yeah.
So to spread this ideology of Ruskin and the British aristocratic elite, Rhodes created a secret society and his well-known Rhodes scholarships. And here is Quigley's main thesis, and this is taken from the Anglo-American establishment. Quote, "The Rhodes scholarships, established by terms of Cecil Rhodes' seventh will, are known to everyone. What is not so widely known is that Rhodes, in five previous wills, left his fortune to form a secret society. which was to devote itself to the preservation and expansion of the British Empire. And what does not seem to be known to anyone is that this secret society was created by Rhodes and his principal trustee, Lord Milner, and continues to exist to this day. End quote.
Yeah, and that's the key, right? Continues to exist to this day. And when was Quigley writing this again?
Yeah, so this would have been in the late 1970s.
Okay. So it's reasonable to think that it still continues to exist today, as in 2020 going on 2021.
That's right. And there are a number of people who have tried to track it after Quigley's time. And you mentioned one book by Joseph Plummer, and I think he does a good job at bringing in some current events to go beyond some of the work that Quigley reports.
Yeah, definitely worth reading.
Yeah, so Quigley goes on. He says, quote, "To be sure, the secret society is not a childish thing like the Ku Klux Klan, and it does not have any secret robes, secret hand clasps, or secret passwords. It does not need any of these, since its members know each other intimately. It probably has no oaths of secrecy, nor any formal procedure of initiation. It does, however, exist and holds secret meetings, over which the senior member present presides." End quote. So, this is a serious society. It's a secret society. And in fact, as Quigley meticulously documents in his books with endless details about names, places, and dates, it's like a genealogy. It's been dominating major world events from the beginning of the 20th century. So since the early 1900s.
Yeah. And Dan, I've got another G. Edward Griffin clip here where he discusses this.
"This secret society exists today, continues to exist, and has been a major historical force since World War I. Quigley says that every major event in history, from World War I, has been dominated and directed to a large extent by this secret society."
So I hope you heard that. Every major world event in history from World War I has been dominated and directed to a large extent by this secret society.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's quite shocking. And I just want to go back here, Dave, because it's important to keep in mind that this guy, Carol Quigley, who says this, is no small guy. In fact, he's endorsed by...
"As a teenager, I heard John Kennedy's summons to citizenship. And then as a student at Georgetown, I heard that call clarified by a professor named Carol Quigley."
Yeah, so it's Bill Clinton himself supports Carol Quigley, who says that every major world event in history from World War I was probably dominated to a large extent by the secret society.
Conspiracy, 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 conspiracy fact.
You are listening to the Not Conformed podcast with your hosts, Dan and Dave. You are being deprogrammed.
Ha, this little tune was written by an 8-year-old using GarageBand on an iPhone. Can you imagine that, cool. Dave?
Nice.
This is Gracie. Fooling around, gave us a little bump song here. Well, we're talking about a global conspiracy that has shaped our current world. This is so important. So if you're multitasking, stop, sit down, and listen to this paradigm-shifting information, because we are in the process of being deprogrammed.
Okay, Dan, so you mentioned a secret society. So what exactly is this secret society and how does it work? Let's talk about that.
Well, first of all, there's no specific name for the secret society. It's been called the Rhodesians, the Milner Group, and that's because of its later leader, Alfred Milner. It's been referred to as just the group, the network, even the Cecil Block, because of the early involvement of the Cecil family, which was a wealthy influential, powerful family in British aristocracy. Now, according to Quigley, the formal organization of the group was established around 1890, and it was characterized by a ring structure. So initially, there was an inner group called the Society of the Elect, which was at the outset composed of Rhodes and a junta of three, which included William T. Stead, who was a well-known journalist, Reginald Brett, also known as Lord Esher, who was the advisor to the King and Queen, and also the British statesman Alfred Milner, later Lord Milner, after whom the group was named later on. And then, so you had this Society of the Elect, this inner circle, and then there was the outer circle called the Association of Helpers. And then presumably there was even a circle outside of that and so on.
Yeah, so this organization is like an onion with an inner circle and then successive outer rings.
Yeah.
And here's G. Edward Griffin describing this organizational framework and the inspiration for this organization. And this is from his Quigley Formula lecture. Once again, that should still be up on YouTube.
The structure that Cecil Rhodes created, and remember, this is all described primarily by Professor Quigley, was outwardly modeled after the Jesuit order. But at the deeper level, it was clear that he borrowed the structure from the Illuminati. And now everyone knows that the Illuminati existed at one time. It was created in 1776 by Adam Weishaupt. But shortly thereafter, it was exposed in Bavaria. The police raided it. They arrested its members. They discovered its ledgers and its books and its papers, which is why we know so much about them. They're part of the public record now. We know what the Illuminati was trying to do and how they were structured and how they organized and so forth. And so that's part of the record, but we are told that the Illuminati ceased to exist after that date. I think it probably did. But whether it did or not, certainly others like Cecil Rhodes picked it up. They picked up the concept. I don't know if there's a historical continuity back to Adam Weishaupt. I don't think it makes an awful lot of difference. When we realize that there are people like Cecil Rhodes who read Adam Weishaupt's work and said, hey, this is a good idea, let's use it. And that's basically what Cecil Rhodes did. He adopted the strategy that Weishaupt created of, he called it rings within rings within rings.
So as you just heard, Griffin points out that the inspiration for the group's organization came from the Illuminati and the Jesuits. And the idea was that you have a ring structure and those in the inner rings would control those in the outer rings. And the people in the outer rings weren't necessarily, or were actually by principle, not aware that there even was an inner ring.
Yeah, Dave, that's really important that those in the outer rings aren't aware of the inner ring. And that's why this thing doesn't get exposed. Because people often say, well, if you have a big, you know, conspiracy and there's lots of people involved, somebody is going to chirp, somebody's going to speak out and reveal the whole thing. Well, that could be true, except for what if those people don't know the full extent of the conspiracy because they're just in the outer ring?
That's right. And there are other arguments to deal with that than that Lance DeHaven Smith has in his book, and we'll maybe hold off to the next episode. But, you know, another comment I want to make here is that people think of the Illuminati, oh, this is like Dan Brown stuff. This is all just fictional stuff. Well, no, if we, as Griffin pointed out, there is historical evidence for the existence of the society and its probable secession. Of course, you don't know that it actually ceased, but most likely. And if you want to go for a general overview of what's accepted as historical knowledge on societies, secret societies like the Illuminati and many others, I recommend you check out Professor Richard B. Spence's course, The Real History of Secret Societies. It's on the Great Courses. And the Great Courses are available on Audible for a great deal, just one credit. So it's a real... And he covers a lot of this stuff. He even covers Rhodes in there.
Ooh.
Not in great detail, but it's if you just go and grab it on Audible, you can download the PDF of the course notes and scan it, and you'll see this is actual historically material on secret societies. Yes, they exist, and we do know some stuff about the ones we know some stuff about, right? So That's important, first of all, to note. The Illuminati aren't just a fictional Dan Brown piece. Now, the other thing is, regarding this ring structure, I would highly recommend people read C.S. Lewis's That Hideous Strength. And that's the third book in the Space Trilogy.
Oh, yeah. I remember that Space Trilogy.
Yeah, it's excellent. And you don't necessarily have to read all of them. They're loosely connected based on the central character. But this is a novel. And in novel form here, Lewis very vividly depicts how such a secretive ring structure would or could work, including this idea of how people at the various levels see the importance of their work while being completely ignorant of the levels above them and seeing themselves and their level as being the controlling level. So if you have a hard time just imagining how this could work and how this could be executed, Lewis is your man. That's a fantastic novel. In fact, I would say that it's probably Lewis's most relevant book for our time.
Ah.
Dan, I continue to be amazed at how lucidly Lewis and I would probably say Orwell and Huxley discussed these ideas in their time.
Yeah.
Okay. They wrote about all these concepts, and then how the influencers in the intervening years managed to shift the focus away from this and just put all this knowledge and these ideas back into obscurity.
Yeah, Dave. And we got to talk more about Huxley and Orwell, and hopefully we'll get a chance to do that in the next episode, because they feature into this whole conspiracy. Very fascinating.
Yeah. That's right. So look, back to the point, I guess the question I have is, how did this network spread all around the world? Let's talk about that.
Yeah. Well, according to Quigley, the network was organized in round table groups, which were essentially think tanks that were located all around the world. Now, in Britain, these started with the Royal Institute of International Affairs, the RIIA, also known as Chatham House, after the house where it was located. And round tables like that branched out across the Commonwealth and were established in various places, including South Africa, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and India. Quigley writes about this. So he says the following, quote, Chatham House established branch institutes in various dominions. In each case, the Dominion Institute was formed about a core consisting of the round table group's members in that dominion, end quote. So just for our young listeners, dominions would have been these different quote unquote countries in the Commonwealth, right? So there was a Dominion of Canada, for instance. Now here's the interesting part. The group's American arm was, and is still arguably, the Council on Foreign Relations, which has a revolving door with the American government and is connected to powerful banking interests and also to the media. Evidently, and I'm quoting here from Quigley, listen, quote, the Morgan Bank has never made any real effort to conceal its position in regard to the Council on Foreign Relations. The list of officers and board of directors are printed in every issue of Foreign Affairs, which is a magazine, and have always been loaded with partners, associates, and employees of J.P. Morgan and Company. Then he goes on to say, the RIAA agreed to regard the Council on Foreign Relations as its American branch, end quote.
Interesting.
Yeah. Now, at this point in time, these roundtables are located in countries beyond the Commonwealth and the U.S. and are present in China, Japan, France, the Netherlands, and that's just to name a few of the countries that have these roundtable groups. So they are spread all over the place like the arms of an octopus or like some sort of cancer that's taken over the world.
Yeah. And Dan, for people haven't heard, or for listeners haven't heard of the Council of Foreign Relations, this sometimes abbreviated as a CFR, start paying attention and listening for that term, because it's all, these guys are all over the place, influencing policy and
media.
You know, there are, in fact, at some point we'll have to get into all the other subgroups that connect to these people and that influence all kinds of public and foreign policy all over the place. It's really quite crazy when you see the connections.
Yeah, and Dave, this is how they're able to control so many things, because they have this hierarchical structure. And so they basically take a hold of these these groups, and then those groups influence other groups, and it just kind of goes down this hierarchical structure. The influence goes down this hierarchical structure, and that's the way a few people at the top can influence a lot of events occurring at the bottom.
That's right. And I think you mentioned the media. I think it's the Epoch Times that has this graphic where it shows the CFR and their connections to all the major media outlets. I don't know if I can find that to link it, but it's a very interesting infographic.
Yeah, I remember seeing that the CFR was like in the middle, right? and it was connected to all these people. All these people were connected with it. And then those people were the heads or the decision makers of all the main legacy media companies in the US, and it's probably the case in Canada as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's very few companies, media companies, that control all the news, all the mainstream news, right? And so it starts to make a lot of sense when you see the collusion and the blockading of certain types of messages, how this could actually happen, right?
Yeah.
How that takes place. And you know, going back to the banking connection, we're going to have to explore that a little in a future episode. But just for now, you know, even just take note of all the Wall Street connected insiders that Joe Biden is announcing in his top picks for his planned administration, right?
It's frightening.
they're all over the place, right? And yeah, you know, the other thing that I wanted to point out that's very interesting is in recent weeks, there has surfaced several videos of a Chinese professor by the name of Di Dongsheng, if I'm pronouncing that right, and who apparently is the professor of international political economy and vice dean of the School of International Relations at Renmin University. And on the YouTube description for one of his videos, it says, according to Di Dongsheng's bio page at Renmin University, Di is a frequent advisor to the Chinese Communist Party and government agencies, including the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the International Liaison Department of the Central Committee of the Chinese Communist Party. Okay, so this guy is well connected, and he's also an academic on this. He's kind of an expert on this, and he apparently gave this interview that has now surfaced on YouTube and made some rounds, and hopefully it'll still be linked so you can watch it. Yeah, by the time the show notes go up, but here he talks about his understanding of the deep state. Now, I don't know how to do this because, let me think here. Let me play the video and I can read you some of the subtitles, although I will probably not be in sync with what he's talking about. So anybody that knows Chinese will realize this is just for show, but
that's all right. They'll make it interesting. Just make sure you turn the volume down so we can hear you clearly.
Yeah, let's hear his voice, and then I'll get into it too. I'll do the, because they have been subtitled by somebody, and there's a couple of different versions, and obviously we don't know any Chinese, so we haven't had a chance to verify the subtitles, but there's a couple of different versions, and they all basically mesh with each other, so we're going to take them as accurate in any case for now. So let's hear it. This is the first video, a first clip, and then I've got another one. So you'll have to excuse the translation here. It's a little bit broken English. There are now many people in Chinese society who do not do American studies and know very little about American society and American politics. These people have now become experts in American issues, experts on the American economy, and experts on U.S.-China economy. In fact, no one represents the United States, but different interest groups. Or another translation says there is no United States, but just simply different interest groups. American society is particularly divided today with elite circles that we call establishments. Within the establishments is a group we call the deep state. My understanding of this group is that it is a group of middle and senior officials in the U.S. military, intelligence system, State Department, Treasury, Commerce, Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, and Judicial System. In other words, they are the big fish in the swamp that Trump hates in the I-495 inner loop, or otherwise known as the Capitol Beltway inner loop, in the United States. American politicians are elected and come and go as passengers. Those who always stay in the American inner circle of power are the group I'm talking about. I have interacted with this group. They have class, passion, ability, capital, and experience. This group is schoolmates with each other because they all graduated from the same elite schools and then went into various ministries at a young age. They are the ones who have dominated today's world for the past 70 years, running the entire world capitalist system and fighting the Cold War. It is this small circle that dominates our world today.
Dave, this is precisely the Quigley narrative coming out of the mouth of a Chinese political analyst. See,
that's right.
Even the Chinese consider this a conspiracy fact. So, Dave, I just have to play this one more time.
Conspiracy, 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 conspiracy fact.
Yeah, and they're clearly making their foreign policy based on this fact. When you listen and read the rest of the interview, there's several different interviews, and you can read the subtitles for them, and you can see how that plays in and how Joe Biden plays in. That's the really interesting one.
Yeah, and Dave,
I'll link that one in the show notes too.
Yeah. I just want to make this important point as well. What this implies, and this is an important point that's actually made by Quigley himself in his books, is that this, what's called this Anglo-American empire, this network, it is distinct from the Communist Party, from the communists in general, which, you know, now seem to be mostly present as in the form of the Communist Chinese Party in China. So these are, this is not the same group. They are different groups. Although, as we'll see maybe in the later episode, is that they both have a very similar end in mind, which is some sort of a top-down, technocratically controlled utopia, mostly for themselves, not so much for the masses.
That's right. And we'll have to talk. They have a collectivist understanding, which we're, we'll just, I'll put that out there and we can unpack that in a later episode.
Yeah.
Now, look, I've got another clip here and it's very interesting. It's from the same guy from the same interview. And it's interesting because he starts talking about Trump. And I think that it sheds light on this other clip I have that I'm going to play for you, where Trump makes this side comment at a press conference. And when you listen to them together, it just fits. So let me play you this second part here, just to continue that clip there. And I will read the subtitles. So what does this group think of Trump? This group is extremely disdainful of Trump, and they believe that they are the true masters of the American empire, and Trump is an outsider. Now, I'm going to skip a bit here. And at the end of 2016, when American democracy became real all of a sudden, it was beyond the group's expectations. It was a big surprise to them that someone like Trump had come to power and become their boss. So you can imagine how this group felt at the time. Absolutely disillusioned, like the sky was falling. So, for the past 2 years, the people who have been insisting on fighting against Trump are in fact the people in this circle. They are using their professional advantage, resource advantages, and informational advantages to play Trump by playing the contrary to Trump's policy.
Dave, I notice that he's using words. I mean, this is a translation here, but he's using words like the group and this circle, right? So it's lining up very nicely with Quigley's narrative.
Yeah, and it makes a lot of sense because we've had articles that have over the last 4 years come out. You know, the news coverage is 93% negative against Trump. And you have this giant media blockade against the fact that with the election and the election fraud, and no, you can't even talk about it. And all the news outlets seem to be on the same page, even though there's tremendous evidence and presented by many credible people that there is this, that something, there's all kinds of shenanigans with the election. And so it's very interesting because I had this, I was listening to this Trump press conference he gave, and the big thing that he wanted to announce there was the breakthrough in being able to deal with the egregious drug pricing in the U.S. And so he managed to get this done. He managed to knock down the pricing of drugs, and it's going to make a huge difference in people's lives. And this clip I have is from that speech where he talks about, after the election, he talks about the drug pricing, but in the middle of the thing, he at least the context for this clip, he's talking about the vaccines and the delay in the vaccines and how that was political. And then that leads him to comment on the election. And he throws in this very interesting side comment. So listen to it and see if you catch it.
So they waited and waited and waited, and they thought they'd come out with it a few days after the election. And it would have probably had an impact. Who knows? Maybe it wouldn't have. I'm sure they would have found the ballot someplace, the Democrats and the group. These corrupt games will not deter us from doing what is right for the American people.
So did you catch it?
Play one more time.
Yeah. All right. Maybe just started a little bit partway through.
After the election. And it would have probably had an impact. Who knows? Maybe it wouldn't have. I'm sure they would have found the ballot someplace, the Democrats and the group. These corrupt games will not deter us from doing what is right for the
American. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you know, I mean, it wasn't part of the script, right?
The Democrats and the group.
It wasn't part of the script because he just throws it in there in typical Trumpian fact. The Democrats and the group.
Yeah, that's
okay. Now, look,
Dave, it's very interesting because he says Democrats and the group. So he's not saying a group of Democrats. So he can't be referring to those three or four, whatever, ultra socialist women in the U.S. government. What are they called?
They're called the squad.
The squad. And they're not even, so he's not talking about that. Right? He's talking about the group. Oh, this is very interesting.
That's right. That's right. And so which group is this? Well, I think this is the Milner group. This is the group.
This is the network. Oh,
right. This is the network, right? Because he knows what he's up against and what he just hit a brick wall on.
Yeah.
Right.
Trump might be aware of the Milner group.
Tell everyone about the Not Conform Show. Singing this jingle wherever you go. How can they listen if they do not know?
You are listening to Dan and Dave, and we're talking about a global conspiracy that centers around a group of elites, which has its origin in the British Empire, but which now has expanded all over the world like a terrible malignant tumor. And again, you're listening to a bump song created by an 8-year-old on an iPhone. This is insane.
We just got to find somebody with a good voice to read that for us.
That's right. We need this big, deep, booming voice.
That's right. Yeah, definitely. All right, Dan. So let's talk about the goals and views of these people and this network, this group, as Trump calls them.
Yeah, we don't have much time left, so we'll just do a shortened version of this. And we can expand on it in the next episode. But at its inception, the main goal was to expand the British Empire and to spread British ideals. And I have a passage here from Quigley, and he writes of three key ideas shared by group members. So these are like a series of quotes here. So first of all, A conviction that the history of the British Empire represents the unfolding of a great moral idea, the idea of freedom. B, a conviction that the first call on the attention of any man should be a sense of duty and obligation to serve the state. And C, a feeling of the necessity to do social service work. End quote.
Yeah, so you basically have socialism. Right? You
get the, that's right.
The duty to state above all things and social work. But I'm curious about this concept of freedom. What was their idea there? That's interesting.
Yeah. It's critically important that we understand the group's definition of freedom. And here's a relevant passage from Quigley's book. Quote, history for this group presented itself as an age-long struggle between the principles of autocracy and the principles of commonwealth, between the forces of darkness and the forces of light, between Asiatic theocracy and European freedom, end quote. And he goes on, the members of the group, quote, felt that the distinguishing mark between the two hosts could be found in their views of law. The forces of light regarding law as man-made and mutable, but yet above all men, while the forces of darkness regarded law as divine and eternal, yet subordinate to the king. The one permitted diversity, growth, and freedom, while the other engendered monotony, stultification, and slavery. And then we skip a few lines, and he says, Britain's mission under this interpretation was to carry freedom and light, that is, the principles of the Commonwealth, against the forces of theocracy and darkness, that is, autocracy in Asia and even in Central Europe, end quote.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's kind of a false dichotomy that they set up there, right? Mm-hmm. It's easy to create false views because the monarchy was often conflated with the church in awkward ways and all that kind of stuff. But notice that they saw divine law as darkness.
Yes.
That is upside down.
Yeah. Right? They saw divine law as darkness and as something to be freed from.
Yeah. And it's interesting. The elites see themselves as above the law, just like Cecil Rhodes, right? I think you read that the forces of light regarding law, as man-made immutable, and yet above all men, except for the elites.
Yeah, that's precisely it. And we know this actually because Rhodes rode roughshod all over the various rules that he helped put in place so that he could grow his wealth and create a monopoly.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And this is where I think Quigley is becoming a bit of an apologist, right? So he says, let me go back to that quote. The forces of light regarded law as man-made and mutable, but yet above all men. And that's not true. They viewed law as being man-made and mutable and for everyone except for themselves. They are always operating above the law and subverting the law. The law is really there to keep the rest of us sheep within our pens so that we can never emerge and join their ranks.
Yeah, and Plummer actually delves into this, and I'm blanking on the term that he gives them in terms of the philosophical stream of thought, but this idea that the elite have no moral restrictions, no moral bindings, and how we underestimate that is a critical concept to understand because you cannot understand what they'll do and why they'll do it unless you understand that they consider themselves above any moral restrictions whatsoever.
Yeah,
other than pure utilitarian, I need to achieve my objectives.
Yeah, that's right. Because fundamentally, they see themselves as being more intelligent and more capable than everybody else. So whatever they deem to be the right thing to do becomes morally the right thing to do. You understand? Yeah, they've basically made themselves into gods.
That's right. And I think Plummer talks about it this way. He says, if you achieved your objective, then it was the right thing. If you failed to achieve your objective, then it was the wrong thing.
Yes, that's right.
That's basically the way to boil down the way they conceptualize this. And so you see this as completely, really quite demonic in its origin, at least from a Christian perspective, to have to look at morality this way.
It's completely demonic. I totally agree. That's what you would say from a Christian perspective. And so when you see this form they call Joe Biden standing up and there's words flowing out of his mouth, you might take a guess where those words originated.
I like your form. So you got to read, people got to read the C.S. Lewis book, and then that takes on a whole different.
Yeah. Different the meaning. Hideous strength. Was he referring to Biden?
Yeah. No. But this whole idea of this kind of zombie form walking around.
Anyways. Yeah. Well, ultimately.
Really good. But,
sorry, go on.
Go ahead.
I'm laughing again too hard. Yeah. Well, I guess ultimately, the goals of this group reach beyond just the establishment of the British Empire, and it involved ushering in a global system of control, or we could say a global government. And here's what Quigley writes, quote, to the older men, the world was to be united around the British Empire as a nucleus. To Curtis, who is a later joiner to the group as an aside, quote, The empire was to be absorbed into a world organization. This second idea was fundamentally mystical. Curtis believed, "Die and ye shall be born again." He sincerely felt that if the British Empire died in the proper way, by spreading liberty, brotherhood, and justice, it would be born again in a higher level of existence, as a world community, or as he called it, a commonwealth of nations, end quote. And consistent with this view, the group has in fact been the driving force behind globalization in the last 100 years. They were responsible for drafts of the Covenant of the League of Nations, which was created after World War I as a globalist enterprise, ostensibly to keep international peace. And so our younger listeners might want to look into that. The League of Nations was the precursor, of course, to the current United Nations, the formation of which was triggered by World War II. And evidently, the group also had a role in that, as well as the global financial system set up at the Bretton Woods Conference. So all of those major events that essentially set up what we know today as our main institutions were partly driven by this network or by this Milner group.
Yeah, and I've got a couple of clips from Griffin here that support and expand on these both these points that you just made. Let me play the first one here, and this is, let me just play it.
It was no longer the British Empire that was to be at the center, but there was a world government to be created. The geographical axis shifted from London to New York and became the United Nations. But nevertheless, the original concept that the members of the secret society would rule from behind the scenes.
So you have these elites, right? And they're setting up global bodies like the United Nations, like you just said, mm-hmm. and they control from behind the scenes.
Yeah.
Okay. So power, this is another thing we'll get into the work of John Taylor Gatt at one point. Power is never where it appears to be. That's a key concept behind this stuff.
Yeah. And these elites, they like to be hidden. They don't want to draw attention to themselves. As soon as you see somebody drawing attention to themselves, they are not a high part of this group or an inner circle member of this group. You probably won't know much about the inner members of this group right now.
That's right. That's right. And that's the key thing. So when you have, like the Chinese experts said, the politicians come and go, right? They just come and go. The real power is the power that stays and that doesn't change. Even as administrators change and people change and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So here's another clip quoting Quigley. This is Griffin quoting Quigley again.
Now back to Quigley's words. He said that the goal of this secret society was, and I quote, nothing less than to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political systems of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. The system was to be controlled in a feudalist fashion by the central banks of the world, acting in concert by secret agreements arrived at in frequent private meetings and conferences. End quote.
Again, and that was, so that was Griffin quoting Quigley. And again, that's Professor Quigley who made that point, right? Not some right-wing conspiracy dingbat.
Yeah, exactly.
It's important to make this point because it's there's been so much counter-propaganda against this or propaganda against this that we have to keep making that point. And we're going to come back to the financial techniques because this is a huge component of this. In fact, it was my reading of The Monster of Jekyll Island. That whole Federal Reserve issue, that was one of the turning points where I realized how this works and it becomes convincing. So we'll have to cover that in more detail. But the key takeaway point right now is that the group's main goal was world political domination. And he refers to this entire elite system as being one of feudalism, right?
Yeah.
Which is a system that was present in medieval Europe. The key concept being that people lived on land owned by lords. So you weren't, it was just the lords that were the landowners and you had to give the lords payment in various services in order to be able to live on their land.
Yeah, and we're going to see this theme come out as we discuss in later episodes more of the Great Reset, this idea that you don't own anything and you're completely happy, but somebody's going to own this. Somebody's going to own the things that you now own. And, you know, part of this whole Great Reset is some sort of a wealth redistribution, and it's not from the elites down to the people. It's going to be from the middle class leaking all its resources off to the elites, in fact.
Yeah, and one point, can't remember now which commentator made this, but if you're a borrower, then you're a slave.
Yes.
Right? And they all want to make us into renters and borrowers and indebted to the system, like this feudal style system.
We're going
to
be slaves. Love your servitude, Dave.
Yes, that's right. Thank you, Huxley.
Well, yeah, we're going to come back to Huxley next time. But Dave, this brings us back now to the speech that our Prime Minister Justin Trudeau gave. Remember the one that we started the show with? Well, I have this gem of a clip from a speech Trudeau gave in 2017 when he accepted the Atlantic Council Global Citizen Award. Yes, you heard that right. The Global Citizen Award. And your ear should perk up now that you've learned about this. Whenever you hear things like the Atlantic Council, you want to think, you want to think round table group, because it's very likely a round table group that was set up that's part of this network that we've been discussing. But here's a clip.
Some might look at this council's half century old mission to promote cooperation across the Atlantic.
Sorry, just one quick thing.
Yeah.
Half century old mission of this council. That means that it was created half a century ago, which would have been at the time that Quigley was writing about this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's mind-boggling here how all this connects.
Yep.
Now let's listen to that again.
Some might look at this council's half-century-old mission to promote cooperation across the Atlantic as the rarefied concern of elites, or an idealistic throwback to another century.
So here he even acknowledges that some would link the Atlantic Council's goals of unifying parts of the world as a goal of the elites in the past century, which is exactly the time that Quigley was talking about. See, most people, Dave, wouldn't know what Trudeau meant here. But once you know the history, you know exactly what Trudeau means. He's linking this back to this Milner group, to the Quigley history. And these sorts of statements that Trudeau includes are not just throwaway phrases. They are, to use that term that's used against Trump, dog whistles to his globalist buddies and his globalist overlords, because, you know, he's just a little puppet. He's not the sharpest tool in this globalist tool shed, but he certainly seems to be a part of this. And then there's this part of the speech. Listen to this.
It is a time for the Atlantic democracies to renew our commitment to universal standards of rights and liberty enforced through a multilateral, rules-based order that has promoted peace and stability and stood the test of time.
He gets a big clap here in the middle of this clip.
Yeah.
We have to work together on this, which means a renewed commitment to long-standing alliances such as NATO and NORAD, bodies such as the United Nations and the WTO.
Yeah, so he wants to promote the multilateral rule-based order, and he wants to renew commitment to globalist bodies like the United Nations and the WTO, which is the World Trade Organization. These are precisely the bodies that would have been created or heavily influenced by this Milner group, Dave.
Yeah, and in fact, you reminded me, there was back in 2017, I think it was. Yeah, it was. Let me just quickly look it up here. It was a Guardian article in 2017, where Trudeau called Canada the first post-national state. And it was weird back then because, you know, I think, what is he talking about? But listen to this. This is what he says. The Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, articulated this when he told the New York Times Magazine that Canada could be the first post-national state. He added, there is no core identity, no mainstream in Canada.
Yeah. Yeah. The idea is to break down the nations and to make them part of a global, centrally controlled commonwealth. And so now we would refer to that as globalism. But so you want to break down these identities so that they would all kind of fuse together under the control of a new world order. And see, unless you understand this Quigley formula or this Quigley history, these things just seem like they just pop up and it's like, oh, that's kind of a nice idea. There's no core identity because we're all different and blah, blah, blah. And yes, we need to renew commitment to these various wonderful bodies like the United Nations and the World Health Organization, right? Which is pushing this whole COVID narrative and it's going to be pushing these vaccines and so on. So unless you understand this history, it just all seems to be disconnected and popping up out of nowhere and just somehow the random marching of time moving forward. But once you learn the history, you really see that this is all interconnected and that they're working from a single common playbook.
Yeah. And the other part of it is, even if it doesn't seem random or disconnected, it certainly seems benign. It seems like people having great ideas, wanting the world to get along. And if you don't see the agenda behind the global one world order, then you don't think it's that threatening.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Dave, I have a few more quotes here, just very quick ones, short ones about their elite rule. And a foundational belief among the group members was that people needed to be ruled and led by an enlightened, intelligent elite. We've referred to this already. This was essentially the view they inherited from people like Ruskin, because that was his main idea, right? These intelligent people have to rule the world. Here's what Quigley writes, quote, "To Milner, to Curtis, and apparently to most members of the group, democracy was not an unmixed good, or even a good, and far inferior to rule by the best, or as Curtis says, by those who have some intellectual capacity for judging the public interest." End quote, right? So, you know, democracy is this idea that people ultimately rule. The rule is in the hands of the people, but they don't like that idea. It's not very good unless you control democracy. And we'll discuss more about that maybe in the next few episodes, how this group actually subverts democracy so that we all feel like we're in control, but we're actually not. Anyways, we already mentioned that the group's views at times were socialistic. So here are a few relevant quotes from Quigley. Quote, "To be sure, it was an undemocratic kind of socialism, which was willing to make many sacrifices to the well-being of the masses of the people, but reluctant to share with these masses political power that might allow them to seek their own well-being." End quote. Another quote, "Escher regarded the destruction of the middle class as inevitable and felt that the future belonged to the workers and an administrative state," end quote. So, I mean, it's just blatantly stated here, right? Mm-hmm. You're going to have an administrative state, which is going to control people through technocracy. And then you just have this group of workers, which will be probably just right at the, or just above a level of poverty. Okay, final quick quote here. Quote, "Milner was a combination of technocrat and guild socialist," end quote. So, I mean, it's all there, Dave. It's spelled out. We know exactly what's going on. The focus was to eliminate the middle class and create a ruling class of intelligent and enlightened technocrats who would rule over the working class sheeple, and to do this at a global level, not just in a particular country, but at a global level.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we're now seeing happen during this COVID tyranny. In fact, the pandemic seems to have enabled the enactment of this on a global scale that wasn't really possible before.
This is the Not Conform Show. Make sure you tell everyone you know.
Well, Dave, we've got a lot more to say on this topic, but maybe we should end the episode here and summarize. Do you think we should do that? Mm-hmm. Or do you have something else you want to add before that?
No, this is good. Yeah, this is a good place to stop, I think.
Okay. So in this episode, we covered the history of a well-documented and factual global conspiracy. It's a conspiracy fact. And this conspiracy involves a group of elites organized in a ring structure with round table groups in many countries of the world. These elites aim to install a global technocracy that will control centrally the people of the world. And they have created global institutions to promote an elite-ruled form of collectivism. Now, in the next episode, we hope to elaborate on this conspiracy and to explain how the group obtained control over the main institutions of our society, including government, media, and education, and how it uses propaganda as its main tool to promote its worldview and to control the masses. So stay tuned. This is information you won't want to miss.
Let's close off then in terms of where to find us. Now, once again, on the web, you can find us on the web at nutconformed.show. And there you'll find the individual episode pages and the show notes and the subscribe links and all the embedded players to listen online and all that kind of stuff. And if you have any problem with that, there's an alternate URL, the nutconformed.simplecast.com, where that's our Simplecast site, which normally is at nutconformed.show. And the best way to spread the word really is just point people to nutconformed.show and they can subscribe from there. So we'd like to thank everyone who sent us feedback and links and articles, and we greatly appreciate all that. We do get things from listeners and we archive it to talk about. Sometimes I do get a chance to respond to people. Sometimes I don't, as you've noticed, we're having a tough time just getting the episodes out. So, but we do want to hear from you. That keeps us going. So email us at info@nutconformed.show. And I've created a new Proton Mail account for us. So info@nutconformed.show now forwards to nutconformed@protonmail.com instead of before it was a Gmail account. So if you want to email us and you want to stay within the Proton Mail system, which is allegedly encrypted. So anybody that wants to do that, just email us at nutconformed@protonmail.com. And eventually I'll get that set up. So it's not just the forward, but it's actually the email account for the show. But for now, if you email info@nutconformed.show, you'll get a response from nutconformed@protonmail.com. And the other thing I did was I created a Gab account, which is @nutconformed. Now, I don't know if that'll stay, but I really like the Andrew Torba's resistance against the technocracy lockdown, and it's a great social network. So I created the account. We'll see if we get any interaction there, or if I keep on top of it, or how that goes. But that's also another new thing. And if you want us to be somewhere, then let us know if there's a good way to interact with you. Let us know, and we'll see if we can sustain it. We can make it happen. So I think that's it, Dan, for this episode, and looking forward to getting deeper into this global conspiracy business. And I'm going to definitely have some material on the Conspiracy Theory in America book by Lance DeHaven Smith.
All right, Dave, I'm looking forward to talking more about this conspiracy fact in our next episode. I'll talk to you then.
Sounds good.